He was right, Louis realized. The cycles moved faster than any information-sending device the natives were likely to have, unless they had semaphores. Speaker continued, "We need to know something of the behavior of humans in the savage state. Louis, Teela?"
"I know a little anthropology," said Louis.
"Then when we make contact, you will speak for us. Let us hope that our autopilot makes an adequate translator. We will contact the first humans we find."
They were barely in the air, it seemed, when the forest gave way to a checkerboard of cultivated fields. Seconds later, Teela spotted the city. It resembled some earthly cities of previous centuries. There were a great many buildings a few stories tall, packed shoulder to shoulder in a continuous mass. A few tall, slender towers rose above the mass, and these were joined together by winding ground car ramps, definitely not a feature of earthly cities. Earth's cities of that era had tended to heliports instead.
"Perhaps our search ends here," Speaker suggested hopefully.
"Bet you it's empty," said Louis.
He was only guessing, but he was right. It became obvious as they flew over. In its day, the city must have been terrible in its beauty. One feature it had which would have been the envy of any city in known space. Many of the buildings had not rested on the ground at all, but had floated in the air, joined to the ground and to other buildings by ramps and elevator towers. Free of gravity, free of vertical and horizontal restrictions, these floating dream castles had come in all shapes and a wide choice of sizes. Now four fly cycles flew over the wreckage. Every floating building had smashed lower buildings when it fell, so that all was shattered brick and glass and concrete, torn steel, twisted ramps and elevator towers still reaching into the air. It made Louis wonder again about the natives. Human engineers didn't build air castles. They were too safety-conscious.
"They must have fallen all at once," said Nessus. "I see no sign of attempted repairs. A power failure, no doubt. Speaker, would Kazinti build so foolishly?"
"We do not love heights so well. Humans might, if they did not so love their lives."
"Booster spice," Louis exclaimed. "That's the answer. They didn't have booster spice."
"Yes, that might make them less safety conscious. They would have less of life to protect," the puppeteer speculated. "That seems ominous, does it not? If they think less of their own lives, they will think less of ours."
"You're borrowing trouble."
"We will know soon enough, Speaker. Do you see that last building? The tall, cream-colored one with the broken windows?"
They had passed over it while the puppeteer spoke. Louis, who was taking his turn at flying the cycles, circled for another look.
"I was right. You see, Speaker? Smoke."
The building was an artistically twisted and sculpted pillar some 20 stories tall. Its windows were rows of black ovals. Most of the windows of the ground floor were covered. The few that were open poured thin gray smoke into the wind. The tower stood ankle-deep among one- and two-story homes. A row of those homes had been smashed flat by a rolling cylinder which must have fallen from the sky. But the rolling wreckage had disintegrated into concrete rubble before it reached that single tower. The back of the tower was the edge of the city. Beyond were only rectangles of cultivation. Humanoid figures were running in from the fields, even as the fly cycles settled. Buildings which had looked whole from high up were obvious wrecks at rooftop level. Nothing was untouched. The power failure and its accompanying disasters must have occurred generations ago. Then had come vandalism, rain, all the various corrosions caused by small life forms, oxidation of metals, and something more. Something that in Earth's prehistoric past had left village mounds for later archaeologists to browse through. The city dwellers had not restored their city after the power failure. Neither had they moved away. They had lived on in the ruins. And the garbage of their living had accumulated about them. Garbage. Empty boxes, windborne dust, inedible parts of food, bones, and things comparable to carrot leaves and corn cobs. Broken tools. It built up when people were too lazy or too hard-worked to haul the rubbish away. It built up, and the parts softened and merged, and the pile settled under its own weight and was compressed further by heavy feet year by year, generation by generation. The original entrance to the tower was already buried. Ground level had risen that far. As the fly cycles settled on hard-packed dirt, 10 feet above what had once been a parking area for large ground-bound vehicles, 5 humanoid natives strode in solemn dignity through a second-story window. The window was a double bay window, easily large enough to accommodate such a procession. Its sill and lintel were decorated with 30 or 40 human-looking skulls. Louis could see no obvious pattern to their arrangement. The 5 walked toward the cycles. As they came near, they hesitated, invisible doubt as to who was in charge. They too looked human, but not very. Clearly they belonged to no known race of man. The 5 were all shorter than Louis Wu by 6 inches or more. Where it showed, their skin was very light, almost ghost white in contrast to Tila's merely Nordic pink or Louis's darker yellow-brown. They tended to short torsos and long legs. They walked with their arms identically folded, and their fingers were extraordinarily long and tapering, so that any of the 5 would have been a born surgeon in the days when men still performed surgery. Their hair was more extraordinary than their hands. On all 5 dignitaries, it was the same shade of ash blonde. They wore their hair and beards combed but uncut, and their beards covered their faces entirely, except for the eyes. Needless to say, they all looked alike.
"They're so hairy," Tila whispered.
"Stay on your vehicles," Speaker ordered in a low voice. "Wait until they reach us, then dismount. I assume we are all wearing our communicator discs?" Louis wore his inside his left wrist. The discs were linked to the autopilot aboard the Lyre. They should work over such a distance, and the Lyre's autopilot should be able to translate any new language. But there was no way to test the Tanj things except in action. And there were all those skulls. Other natives were pouring into the former parking lot. Most of them halted at the sight of the confrontation in progress, so that the crowd formed a wide, rough circle well outside the region of action. A normal crowd would have grumbled to itself in speculation and wagers and arguments. This crowd was unnaturally silent. Perhaps the presence of an audience forced the dignitaries to decide. They chose to approach Louis Wu. The 5, they didn't really look alike. They differed in height. All were thin, but one was almost a skeleton, and one almost had muscles. 4 wore shapeless, almost colorless brown robes. A 5th wore a robe of similar cut, cut from a similar blanket, but in a faded pink pattern. The one who spoke was the thinnest of them. A blue tattooed bird adorned the back of his hand. Louis answered. The tattooed one made a short speech. That was luck. The autopilot would need data before it could begin a translation. Louis replied. The tattooed man spoke again. His 4 companions maintained their dignified silence. So, incredibly, did their audience. Presently, the discs were filling in words and phrases. He thought later that the silence should have tipped him off. It was their stance that fooled him. There was the wide ring of the crowd, and the 4 hairy men in robes, all standing in a row, and the man with the tattooed hand, talking. "We call the mountain Fist of God." He was pointing directly starboard. "Why? Why not, if it please you, engineer?" He must have meant the big mountain, the one they had left behind with the ship. By now it was entirely concealed by haze and distance. Louis listened and learned. The autopilot made a dandy translator. Gradually a picture built up, a picture of a farming village living in the ruins of what had once been a mighty city. "True, Zignamu Klik-Klik is no longer as great as it once was, yet our dwellings are far superior to what we could make for ourselves. Where a roof is open to the sky, still the lower floor will remain dry during a short rainstorm. The buildings of the city are easy to keep warm. In time of war they are easily defended and difficult to burn down. So it is, engineer, that though we go in the morning to work our fields, at night we return to our dwellings along the edge of Zignamu Klik-Klik. Why should we strain to make new homes when the old ones serve better?" 2 terrifying aliens and 2 almost humans, unbearded and unnaturally tall, all 4 riding wingless metal birds, speaking gibberish from their mouths and sense from metal discs, Small wonder if the natives had taken them for the Ringworld builders. Louis did nothing to correct the impression. An explanation of their origin would have taken days, and the team was here to learn, not to teach.